open the House Committee on Business and Labor and thank all of you for showing up to this last interim hearing. And we're going to start off with an analysis of per capita personal income. Can I just go right into it?
Mm-hmm.
And call up Graham Slater from the Administrator of Workforce Economic Research Division, Oregon Employment Department. Good morning.
Morning. Chair Shelfer and members of the committee for the record. My name is Graham Slater, and as I said, I'm the Administrator for the Economic and Workforce Research Division of the Oregon Employment Department. So I appreciate your time to share with you the results of this new report. I think many of you have copies of it. New report that we just recently released about Oregon's per capita personal income, and particularly, in fact, about the gap between Oregon's income and the U.S. average income. So we'll go into more details in a few seconds here. The history of the project really started this summer when the governor asked our staff to just give kind of a very quick analysis, a two-week analysis on this topic, because it was getting more and more attention as the state was still suffering from this huge recession, and then also as we saw the income slipping down, of course, that has the impact on general fund. And one of the thoughts was, okay, even if we have a high unemployment rate and lots of job losses, if our income per job or our overall income were higher, there would be more taxes coming in for general fund. So why is it that we have this kind of gap between our income and the U.S. income? So we did that research. We visited with the governor, turned into a much longer project because we felt there's a lot of people that would probably benefit from having this kind of information. So that's the background. I do want to also point out that none of the data that I'll share with you this morning, or essentially none of it, comes from the Employment Department. All of the per capita personal income data comes from a U.S. Federal government agency, the Bureau of Economic Analysis. So what we're doing here is reporting data that exists for all states nationwide. We've done a lot of analysis on it, but it doesn't come from us. It's not necessarily, in some cases, our expertise. So you'll see that some of them I can talk in some detail on, and others, if you ask questions, I'll probably just say that one's kind of off our scope, but here's what the Bureau of Economic Analysis reports. So let's start with the basic definition. Like the unemployment rate, which my agency does and we're, of course, very familiar with, per capita personal income is a very, very broad measure, and I think it's easy to get into trouble if you try to use it in too precise a way. And so very simply, the mathematical formula is it's all the income of all kinds for all the individuals in the state divided by the total number of people in the state. So yes, that means it's divided by the number of two-year-olds and five-year-olds. And you think, well, that doesn't make any sense. Two-year-olds don't usually have much income. But again, it's just a very broad measure that's been around for decades, and it's available for counties and states, so you can make good comparisons. So just keep in mind it's very broad. And the number for Oregon for the most recent year, 2009, you can see on the slide, 36,125, that's the per capita personal income, the average income per person in Oregon in 2009. And we share above that the total earnings and dividends and rent and so on, and I'll explain those a little bit more, divided by the total population of the state. We did want to provide some important context in these two slides. We did this for the governor when we met with him, and we've done it in every presentation since. First of all, as I said, it's just one of many economic indicators. You've got to kind of keep per capita personal income in balance with all the other things that are going on, employment growth, unemployment rates, and so on. Secondly, it's an estimate, not a perfect number. And as I'll mention in one particular category, there's one category where more than half of the Bureau of Economic Analysis estimate is what they call an adjustment for non-response. So, these are really good people at the national level who are taking all the data they can get their hands on, and then they're filling in the gaps in some of the other stuff. So it's not a precise number. Nobody's actually counting every single dollar. They're making their best estimates on some of it. Most states' per capita personal income is below the national average, so it's not like there's 25 states above and 25 below, and that's because a few states are really high, and they drive up the national average. So to be below the national average isn't that unusual. Doesn't mean we like it. Doesn't mean we want it to stay that way. But there are many states in that same position with us.
Mr. Graham, question real quick. So when you're saying that there are averages that are taken, are there half, 50% or no responses, correct?
Vice Chair Cameron, In the one particular number that I'll share later is proprietor's income. In that particular piece of the estimate, which isn't a huge piece, but in that particular piece, Oregon looks really bad. We're about 70% of the national average just for proprietor's income. But of the Bureau of Economic Analysis estimates, more than 50% of how they calculate that number is an adjustment for non-response or unavailable data.
And how does that compare with the other states, though? Is this survey done nationally, and you have the same type of survey nationally, and would that be taken in consideration in other states as well?
Yes, Vice Chair Cameron. It's the same methodology. In this case, it's not surveys, but it's the same methodology for all states. And so that one, they've got pretty good numbers at the national level, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and then they divvy it out across the states based on kind of a pro-rationing based on other factors.
Thank you.
Okay. So my fourth bullet here, I do want to make a really important point, because we're so focused right now on the fact that there is a gap. We're below the national average. I think it's really important for everyone to understand our per capita personal income has been growing for, as we say, most of the past 70 years. We are, even adjusting for inflation, a whole lot better off today than we were 30, 40, 50 years ago on average. But as the U.S. has done even better, we've fallen behind the U.S. And you'll see that in one of the next graphs. More important context, particularly in the idea of we need to fill this gap, we need to make up the gap, it's a really hard thing to do. And there's a couple reasons why it's really hard. One is, again, it's a very simple mathematical formula. If you want to make up this almost 10% gap, one option is to raise all incomes for everybody in the state from all sources, raise them all by 10%. That's not an easy or likely thing to happen, certainly overnight. It might happen over a very long, gradual period. The only other option, if you can't raise the incomes, is to literally get rid of some of the population, because that's the only other way to make the math work out. And obviously, that's not practical either. And so when we were thinking about this study and presenting it, the immediate next thing that comes to our minds is, well, let's bring in some companies with great jobs that pay really high wages. That will raise our average income. And it would, and it's a great thing, and of course we should be trying to do that all the time. But I give an example on the third bullet here. If we were to bring in 10 companies, each of them with 1,000 jobs, and every one of those jobs paid $100,000 a year, you imagine every one of those would be front page headlines, we'd all be celebrating, but it would only take our per capita personal income from 91.2% of the national average to 91.8%. So it would be a great thing. We'd all, again, be celebrating it, but it doesn't bridge this gap. This gap is about bigger things than that. So, and then just a couple closing thoughts. It's very easy to look back 30, 40 years, because that's how long this issue has been around, really 30 years, and look at policy choices or decisions and kind of start almost a blame game. And we just want to point out that most of the decisions that go into this, they're really no one's fault. They're individual decisions, and particularly one of the big factors, they're individual decisions by people like me and like maybe some of you who have moved to Oregon even though you weren't born here. And Oregon's population, the constant increase in Oregon's population, is perhaps the single biggest factor. It's certainly one of the big factors that makes this a really hard problem to solve. And I'll give you much more detail on that as we go. So let's get into some of the data. The first one, the line that ends at the bottom there is the Oregon line, the kind of darker one. And it bears out the point that I made earlier. Our incomes have grown, even adjusting for inflation. So this is not about a situation where 30 years ago we collectively were making more than we are today. It's about a situation where, yes, we've grown, but we haven't grown as much as the United States. And if you track back through history, you can see one point in the 1940s where our per capita income was a lot higher than the United States average. And you can see through the 60s and 70s where we were pretty much the same. And then in the early 80s, basically it collapsed. And this next slide, if we were the same as the U.S., we'd be right on that line that goes across the middle of the graph. You look back to the 1940s, why were we so high? Believe it or not, it was... I'm sorry.
Can you go back to the next one?
Yep.
Do you have a number on that slide? Because I want to return to it later. That's the one I want to return to when you're done.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if you can just say slide 5.
Okay, thank you.
I'll know where to go back to. Okay. All right. So the time in our history where we were substantially above the United States average was back in the war years, and a lot of that was driven by shipbuilding, believe it or not, something that is not going to be a big factor in today's economy. Okay, it's still an important industry, but not like during the war years. And then, as you can see, in the late 70s, when Oregon was doing very well, and the construction industry was doing really well, and it was a big part of the economy, and the lumber and wood products industry was doing really well, and it was a big part of the economy, and both of those were pretty high wage, in the late 70s, we were above the national average. And then, as some of you will recall, maybe many of you were here, in the early 80s, two different recessions, construction employment cut in half, lumber and wood products employment cut in half, and even to the extent that some of the jobs came back, they often came back at much lower wages. So even if we got the jobs back, they didn't do a good job of helping this income thing. And you can see that in Oregon, ever since the early 80s, we've never again got back to the level of the U.S. average. We did have some good growth years in the mid-90s. And people often talk about that as the semiconductor boom years, which was certainly heavily, not only, but heavily in the Portland area. But there were a lot of other good things going on in the economy in that era too. And then the Asian financial crisis came along, and then another recession. And you can see that from there on, we kind of, you know, we were on an upward trend, and then we lost it, and it's been down pretty much ever since. As I was looking at the bios of the members of the committee, most of you are from the metropolitan areas. You know, you may be on the outskirts of some of them, some of you are right in the middle of them, but the metro areas, as is true with population, as was true in the recent elections, you all know this very well, the metro areas dominate the statistics in a lot of these things, not because they're more important, but just because of the magnitude of the people and the jobs that are in them. And so the metro areas in Oregon account for 82% of our personal income. So when you have a gap with the nation that's as big as ours, it's got to be a focus or a solved, at least partly, substantially, in those metro areas. And on the right of this next graph, you can see the different levels. In Oregon, the average metro area per capita personal income is in the 38,000 range, so much higher than the average rural area, which is in the 30,000 range. But if we compare with like areas across the nation, comparing metro areas with metro areas, the metro areas are only 90% of all metro areas across the nation. And you can imagine some of those are New York City and San Francisco, and we know there's huge differences in cost and so on there, and I'll talk a little bit about cost of living later. But when you compare them with all the metro areas, some of them are tiny, in Texas or Alabama or someplace, places you've never heard of, but they meet the metro area criteria. So when you compare ours, and ours is Portland, Salem, Eugene, Corvallis, Bend, and Medford, those are the six metro areas in Oregon, when you compare ours with the rest of the metro areas in the nation, that's really where a lot of our problem comes from. Interestingly, Oregon's rural areas, even though the income's lower, which I think all of us would know coming into this, they actually are much closer to the norm for rural areas across the nation. And if you look back at the top line on this graph, you can see that Oregon's rural areas typically were above rural areas nationally for years and years and years, and that was heavily because of the wood products industry. We had some really high-paid jobs spread all across the state in very rural counties, and that raised our rural income much higher than the normal rural county across the United States. But in the last few years, even that slipped below the line. So what are the components of this per capita personal income? As you can see, as you saw earlier, there's the dividends, interest, and rent. There's the transfer payments, and examples there would be Social Security or unemployment insurance. But the big group is net earnings. And so that's the one where we'll focus a lot of our time on, because as you can see at the bottom, it's actually net earnings where we fall behind. We're up at or above the national level for the dividend, interest, rent, and for the transfer payments. But it's the earnings from jobs and from self-employment where we really fall behind.
Representative, excuse me.
Sure, is this where the cost of living comes into play here? Like how far your money goes? That's what you mean by dividends, interest, and rents and current transfer receipts? What do you know?
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, no, not really. There will be a separate slide that does kind of compare us with the New Yorks and so on later. The dividends, interest, and rent in this slide is simply saying that's where the income comes from. So
your
investments,
thank you.
Or in the case of transfer payments, it's your Social Security, retirement.
Got it. Just income. Thank you.
Okay. All right. And so this graph just shows you the bottom line is earnings, and you can see that's kind of the problem. The other lines, they might jump around, but as of 2009, we were actually pretty much on par with the U.S. for the dividends, interest, rent, and for the transfer payments. So in a sense, those aren't our problem. Our problem is in the earnings area. So that's the one that we'll dig more deeply into.
We go back to that slide. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Chair. Representative.
I'm just trying to follow this. The solid line is the earnings. The small dotted line is what?
Representative Cameron, that one is the transfer receipts. So the retirement, Social Security, unemployment insurance.
Okay, and then the large dotted line is the...
That one's the dividends, interest, and rent. Right. It's a combination of dividends, interest, and rent. And that's the one that most of the graph is at the top.
And these are all compared to the national average, which is the middle line?
Exactly. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. So again, we spent a lot of our time focusing on the earnings data. And there are three big factors, and what I'm going to share with you is three big factors and then some smaller ones and then some factors that we analyzed, but they didn't end up being an important factor. But I'm sharing them just so that you know we took a look at them. Certainly the big one is if you look across a whole bunch of industries in Oregon, we simply get paid less here. I mean, that's the bottom line, big deal truth. And this isn't about industry mix. This is saying within manufacturing or within construction or within healthcare, we typically, across many industries, get paid less. There are a number of reasons, and some of them are listed below. We tend to work slightly fewer hours. We have a little bit more part-time. None of those are big reasons that would explain it on their own, but they all kind of come together. But in my view, and I've been doing this 27 years, in my view, the big factor is simple demand and supply, just like any other economic product. And I've been using the example of an engineer who could work in New York City for, let's say, $200,000 a year, or that engineer could work in Portland, Oregon for $160,000 a year. And there are many people, and some of you and I may be among them, who would choose to live in Oregon for $160,000 a year and go hiking and go to the coast and go windsurfing or whatever it is, rather than being in New York City for the $200,000. And when I was giving a similar presentation to Oregon's Workforce Board, when I was kind of sharing this concept, one of the business members said, you know, why would businesses pay $160,000 instead of $200,000? Because they can. You know, no business is going to offer $200,000 if they can get a bunch of skilled engineers applying for $160,000. That's just the reality of the demand and supply, the way it works. So we do see that this one alone, if you think of us having this kind of 9 percentage point gap between us and the nation, this lower earnings alone accounts for 3.5 of those 9 points. So this one's a very big deal, and we'll show a few more things. If we look by occupation instead of industry, an interesting thing pops out, and it's because of our high minimum wage. In the lower wage occupations, the ones to the left, the dark blue line is Oregon, and we tend to pay more. And that's because we're having a higher wage for the low wages because of our minimum wage. It's kind of forcing things up, not just for the pure minimum wage workers, but for the ones in the next couple tiers above that. But when you get to the right of the graph, to the higher wage occupations, we're consistently lower. And that's the engineer concept. I mean, it could be any occupation. I just use the engineer as an example.
Why don't you have construction up there? I don't see construction up there.
Mr. Chair, don't see it either.
I'd be interested in that.
We'll certainly right now, there isn't. I'll make a note.
Yeah, that's because there is none in Oregon right now.
No, there is some. Wouldn't you know the one bar missing is
Thank
the chair's bar, right?
You're welcome.
Okay.
I have to attribute the line to my good friend representative. He gave it to me, and I blurted it out.
Thank you.
Give credit where credit's due.
Representative Cameron. Okay.
Keep them coming,
Representative. So moving on beyond the wages that we all earn, this is the one that I mentioned at the beginning where a lot of this estimate is based on this adjustment. So one of the dangers in policymaking is, you know, you can chew or try to solve problems with a new policy or a proposal when the problem is quite possibly just statistical error ranges. And so that's why we want to make this one very clear. But for many years, Oregon proprietaries, which can be tiny businesses, and there's a list in the Bureau of Economic Analysis definitions, you know, it's Schedule C and it's Schedule this, very detailed list, not really our expertise, but there's a list of those, basically people with their own businesses, maybe a small on the side thing, maybe a full-time thing, and we earn significantly less than the national average in this kind of work activity. So it does have an impact, but again, going back to the wages, that's a lot more people on the actual working for other companies with their wages, the one that I showed you moments ago. Okay, a third one that's kind of interesting is that a lot of earnings leave Oregon every year. And we are one of the states with the sixth largest outflow of earnings from Oregon. And the big deal here is that our big city, Portland, is right on the border with Washington. And we know there's lots of commuting, much of it going from Washington into Portland for a job and then going back home. So when we presented this to the governor's reset cabinet, there was this kind of very interesting thought process that went on that said, well, in a sense, this is okay. It's bad news for the per capita personal income because the income's counted where you live. But it's not necessarily bad news for Oregon's general fund because the income tax is paid on where you work. So these, in a sense, are people that are working in Oregon, some of them with very good wages. They're paying income tax in Oregon, but then they're going home to Washington or other places, but many of them to Washington. So we share this because for some states, they get a big adjustment because more of their people work outside, but then go home to live. So their per capita income gets bumped up because of this. Ours gets bumped down.
Mr. Slater, if I may, so are you saying the income is not collected from the employer? In other words, as an employer, I get these things all the time to fill out that take hours and hours because the state wants this information, and I don't get paid for it, by the way. And I fill it out as an employer. What you just said is that this information is coming from the employee and where they live?
Vice Chair Cameron, in this particular data series, this Bureau of Economic Analysis data series, my understanding is a lot of the data comes from the IRS or from other of those kind of tax records. So that would be individuals filing it. It's not an employer survey. Other things that we do, of course, are.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so the bottom line here is the commuting thing will always be kind of a problem for us in terms of per capita personal income. That doesn't mean necessarily it's a problem for us in terms of policy or general fund revenues. And then, as I've mentioned a lot already, population is a really big deal in this whole discussion. If it were likely to have a lot of population growth and a lot of per capita personal income growth at the same time, you would see some little diamonds here. These represent states. You'd see some diamonds way up in the top right corner of this graph. And our little verbiage there points out that you don't see that. We have had, in the early 90s, we did have pretty good population growth and pretty good per capita personal income growth, as I showed you on that earlier slide. So it's possible to do that when all things are coming together, but it's pretty rare. And it doesn't happen very often, and certainly as we look, the time period here is 1996 to 2009, so it's a pretty long time period. And you can see there's no states that are way up in that top right corner. And for a state like Oregon that's pretty consistently adding population, that becomes a problem because the number on the bottom of the formula keeps going up. So the number on the top of the formula, the income, has got to go up a lot to make up for that.
Do we know who any of those states are that are pushing towards the upper corner?
Yes, Vice Chair Cameron, we do have that, and in our report at the back, we kind of have an appendix that lists all the different states and where their per capita personal income is. I don't have each of the diamonds memorized, but in a later slide, I will also talk about some of the states that have moved up, done better than us, and what some of the reasons were. So we could easily get you a list of the top five in each corner if you'd like that.
Thank you.
Okay. Make a note. And actually, this next slide is just one example. One of the groups of states we looked at to compare ourselves with were states that used to be somewhat similar to Oregon, but they've improved more than we have in the last quite a few years, 1996 to 2009. And the diamonds here represent their per capita personal income growth, and you can see they're all doing better than we are. Ours is down kind of almost buried in our bar there. So we're at the 15, 16, 17% range. And Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Kansas certainly are up in the 30% range. But the bars represent the population growth over that same time period. And it just really emphasizes my point that it's hard to have that very high per capita personal income growth when your population is increasing at the pace that ours does. So, you know, maybe not impossible, but over an extended period, very, very hard. Okay, there certainly will be years where you're going to see some quirks for a couple of years here or there, but over the long term, very hard. A couple of smaller factors.
Sure.
Yes, Mr. Holder.
Mr. Slater, on back on that last one, what's the time frame I was trying to read? It was 1996 to 2009, so that's over a 10-year period that you're measuring that. So I'm just curious about the fast growth period. You know, do you have an explanation? Because I can understand if it was just a short time period that, you know, those people that just moved to the state would be reporting their income somewhere else, but over that long of a, I mean, is that why? Is because those people that moved to the state are reporting their income in a different state? It wouldn't seem like that would follow in that large of a time frame. So what is the explanation for that?
So Vice Chair Cameron and Representative Hovey, no, it's not because of that reporting thing. It's simply because, similar to the unemployment rate, we have a lot of people who move to Oregon, even in times like the last 2 years, and they come here and they may not even have a job. So for a while, they don't have any appreciable income. They're counted in the formula because they're now Oregon residents. And maybe initially then they get a lower wage job. You know, it may take them a while to get back to whatever job they were laid off from when they came here.
So it's just sort of follow-up.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of a reflection that when people lose their jobs, they tend to move someplace else to try to find one.
Vice Chair Cameron and Representative Hovey, certainly that is true, but that's only part of the story. A lot of people come here not having lost it. I mean, maybe an example, we come here before we ever lost a job because Oregon and the West Coast in general is very attractive. And so, you know, that's that general population growth we get. And again, when you've got 200,000 unemployed, as we have right now, and maybe something approaching 30,000 job openings, that's a lot of supply for not much demand, and so that impacts the wages that are offered down the road. So it is kind of a long-term thing. It's not just the first 6 months they're here. They're adding to this long-term supply of available workers. Now, skills and other things are a different issue compared with the demand for workers.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Hoyle.
Is the number of people that come here that are no longer in the workforce, so people that come to retire to Oregon, is that at all a factor in these numbers?
Yeah, Vice Chair Cameron and Representative Hoyle, absolutely. It's another great example where everybody who comes here, whether they're 2 years old or 99 years old, they're counted in this very basic formula, income divided by population. So retirees, you know, we used to hear a lot about retirees coming here with a lot of money, buying up property, and, you know, often from California. Those people coming in with big investments and a lot of money, they would help this formula. But to the extent that some retirees come in maybe with medium or lower incomes, right, they would be a drain on this formula. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying mathematically they would be kind of a downward push on the formula. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Slater, I have a question on this slide before you move off. We have Oregon as the highest, in this particular slide, is the highest population growth. Is there other states that have had higher population growth that if you were to continue on, you would add to this, and where would their diamonds fall?
Vice Chair Cameron, I'm confident, I don't remember exactly how many, there are other states with higher population growth. My guess is that they don't have any higher per capita personal income growth, but I would want to check that before I make it the final answer.
That'd be good information to have.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, that would be on the previous chart. It would show diamonds beyond that and where they lie.
Right.
That's true.
Previous chart.
I can go back to that if you wish. So any of the diamonds to the right of Oregon, right, any of them to the right of Oregon would have had higher population growth. So the ones to the right that are above Oregon would be examples where they had higher population growth and their per capita personal income grew more than ours. And we could identify those states.
Yeah, Mr. Those would be really good states to take a look at. Thank you.
Sorry, one more clarification.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
Representative Hoyle.
Just for clarification, so this is per capita personal income, and you separated out income and investments. In this number, are those all included, or, you know, rents, investments, whatnot? So this is all included in that number.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poyle, this is back to everything's included,
okay.
The total per capita personal income. Okay. Moving on. So a couple smaller factors. We do have a larger share of our population in rural areas. And as I showed you at the beginning, the rural areas tend to have lower total income. So the more people that you have in those areas, that will bring you down a little bit. This was not a big factor. It was just one more thing we looked at. And then, as we've mentioned earlier, our cost of living is lower. And if you look at the states here that are the most expensive, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, three of those are also the states with the highest per capita personal incomes. And so there you get into the situation where if you're not making high wages, really high wages in some of those states, you really can't possibly afford to live there. And you know, the incomes and the wages that businesses have to offer get adjusted. Not our study, but a couple of years ago, a study was done that suggested that about one-third of our gap with the nation could be explained by that difference in cost of living. In other words, we're not as bad off as we think because our cost of living doesn't match some of those other states that are doing much better. We also looked at some factors that turned out not to have much impact, but we didn't know that until we looked at them. The industry and occupational mix. You know, there's a couple industries where we're much more heavily concentrated than the nation, but overall, we're not that dissimilar, and it doesn't make much difference. The minimum wage I already chatted with you about. We wondered whether federal government employment was a big deal because Washington, D.C. is way at the top of this particular measure. So it's a big deal in Washington, D.C., where you've got very high-level federal government people as well as contractors. But across the rest of the states, it really isn't that big a deal. And then unionization of the workforce. We wondered if that would be a big deal, and it turned out not to be in Oregon. And the main reason there is, you know, we're quite high in terms of percent of the workforce that's unionized, both public and private, but obviously we're quite low on per capita personal income. So those two don't seem to have a good link, at least in Oregon. There's some other drivers that are far off our expertise, but we list them, and if people want to dig deeper, then there's other experts that could deal with this. One, again, is the quality of life, and Ed Whitelaw, who's a University of Oregon professor 30 years ago in the 80s, coined the phrase the second paycheck, and some of you may remember that phrase, and the concept is basically that Oregonians get one paycheck that's cash, and one paycheck that's this other quality of life, the hiking, the fishing, the coast, whatever it may be that interests them. And again, that really does have an impact on what businesses need to pay or are willing to pay for their workers because of this supply and demand issue. Other issues that are certainly out there, tax structure and investment in education or the education level of the population. And so that those are kind of out there maybe for further discussion, but not part of this particular report. As we looked at that gap over the 96 to 2009 time period, really it was the same old factors that not only started us off low, but kept us low and maybe even made us get lower relative to the U.S. So I won't repeat them, but you can see that it's things we've already talked about. Our employment, in and of itself, over much of history, has grown faster than the U.S. So I would point out this is not about Oregon not creating enough jobs. It's about Oregon having lower earnings in those jobs. Because, yeah, in recessions we suffer a lot, but over the long haul we do a great job of adding a lot of jobs in Oregon, and we far outpace the U.S. in terms of job creation. So it's more about the earnings. Excuse me. Just looking at some of the highest states, many of those are clustered around the East Coast, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maryland, New Jersey, and then one right in the middle is Wyoming, and that one can go up and down very dramatically, mostly depending on energy costs and energy research and so on. So Wyoming, I would say, is completely different. But one of the points we make in the report is that we're very different to almost all of those states. So as Representative Cameron was kind of, I think, thinking a few minutes ago, comparing ourselves with New York may not make much sense. Comparing ourselves with states that used to be like us but have done pretty well, that was one of the things we spent some time on. So, you know, what have similar states managed to do that maybe we haven't? And there's an infinite amount of research that could be done on that. We've started it in this report.
Representative Holby.
I just got to do a check with what I thought I heard. A few minutes ago, you said that Oregon was very high in the amount of jobs it creates. So that doesn't seem to be our issue. We create a lot of jobs. It's just that they're low-wage jobs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, I probably wouldn't go quite as far as saying, you know, they're low-wage jobs, as in they're all low-wage. we have not had huge growth in certain industries where these states, the New Yorks and so on, they've had huge growth in things like financial services and investment banking and so on, where the wages are astronomical. We haven't had that kind of growth in those kind of industries. But we have, we have added high-tech jobs, we've added healthcare jobs, we've added a lot of jobs in moderate to high-wage industries, but not the concentration that some of them have in these incredibly high industries, which has really boosted them up.
Okay.
And so, to summarize, probably there's six to eight pages in the report that compares us with different kinds of states, and I won't go into a lot of detail on those. But here are the big themes that come out over and over again. And as I said, population is one of the big ones. There's faster growth in compensation. It's not that we're not adding jobs, it's that the compensation isn't keeping up. The high-paying industries, which I just mentioned, Representative Holvey, and then again, the part-time work, the lower unemployment rates in those states, all of those really come together to talk about that supply-demand shift. So if you have more unemployed, if you've got more people moving in, all other things being equal, you're going to have less of a need to offer higher wages because there's a lot of people willing to go work for the wages that are being offered. Now, of course, that varies by industry. It varies by occupation. There's shortages in some occupations. There's surpluses in others. But I'm, for now, just talking about the big picture. So some summary slide, just pretty much things I've already said. I'll let the chair know that in my handout I have two more slides on different topics, things that we issued news releases on just this week. And so when I testified in the Senate committee a couple days ago, I just took the time to share those with them. It has to do with businesses' expectation of the coming 6 months and our most recent unemployment rate and employment news release, which was the most positive in a very long time. So there is some good news starting to trickle in. But this is the last slide on this topic, and I'm happy to stop there and just take questions and do whatever you'd like.
So you're done?
I'm done, unless you would like to get those two other slides on the other new topics.
Go ahead.
Okay. So we just completed our first ever Oregon Future Hiring Survey, and the goal here was to add to the information that you all have, frankly, policymakers, governor, adding into our data, to Tom Potowski's data, and to say, we literally asked businesses, what are you expecting in the next 6 months? And then the takeaway messages here, 62% of businesses expect no change in their employment 6 months from now, which is pretty consistent, if you think about it, with Tom's forecast, which is very, very slow growth, okay? 12% of the firms thought they'd have more employees, 15% have fewer. So the big story is there. We're not expecting a huge surge in employment. When I say we're not expecting, actually, this is businesses. We're asking businesses what they think is going to happen in their company in the coming time. We also asked them about their hiring, so they may not add employees, but they may be hiring to replace people that leave. And as you can see, 19% of the hiring they think they will do in the next 6 months was simply turnover. So that's not creating new jobs. That's just replacing people that leave. But only 4% was what we described as restoration. In other words, bringing back the jobs that you lost during the recession. So that's a pretty small fraction, and maybe a disappointingly small fraction of businesses. Hiring will be widespread, and that we have lists of occupations that they think they'll be hiring for. And then, interestingly, at the end, when we asked businesses what are the we gave them up to three barriers that would prevent them from hiring, we thought that maybe, particularly given all the discussion of government and taxes and so on, that would be a lot higher than it was. The big thing on businesses' minds is still the recession and the uncertainty relating to the recession. That's the big thing. Now, a certain percent, 12%, did talk about taxes, but compared with the two-thirds that said the recession is the main thing holding me back, it was a relatively small percentage. And then finally, we released our new employment and unemployment release on Tuesday, and this, in fact, the first bullet is the perfect example of what I've been talking about in terms of population. Oregon's civilian labor force reached an all-time record level last month, over 2 million, first time ever. And you think, well, why would the labor force be so high when we think there's all these discouraged workers? They're not in the labor force. And the reason it's so high is that throughout the recession, people keep moving to Oregon. And we think now, because there is a little bit of positive news, we think some of those discouraged workers are actually coming back in the workforce, but they're coming back in as unemployed people. That's why the unemployment rate probably ticked up a tenth. Because when things start getting better, people who had stopped looking for work will gradually come back in because they're hearing, you know, their brother got hired, their neighbor got hired. Okay, I'm going to get back in the labor force. The big news is on the second and third bullets, really, where we did actually see job growth for the second month in a row. I've testified at other committees that we need 4,000 or 5,000 jobs a month to really start making progress. We lost 150,000 jobs in the recession. We need 4,000 or 5,000 a month over a long period to see progress and to see the unemployment rate even think about coming down. And the last 2 months, we've added more than 6,000. That's the best thing we've seen in 5 years, by far. So that's pretty positive, and manufacturing turned around kind of a three-month losing streak and actually added some jobs. It wasn't as good for construction, which had added some jobs and now lost some. But we just wanted to point out to folks that we've been talking about we need to be adding thousands of jobs each month. And finally, 2 months in a row, it's not a trend, but it's a lot better than the alternatives, 2 months in a row we have added considerable number of jobs. So that's at least very good as far as it goes. Now we will wait for next month's news. So now, Mr. Chair, I am done. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like the lights turned on too, please. Thank you very much. A lot of this stuff just flat out angers me. I'm not angry at you. This is incredibly fascinating information, and I know it's very detailed, and I know it's hard to pinpoint, the source of our problems, but those slides you showed, I know the 80s recessions were really bad and the timber industry's never recovered from it. But you could also show another trend of radically increased rules, regulations, even prohibition placed on the timber industry in the last 30 years that has added to the willful, deliberate attempt to destroy the wood fiber industry in this state, the place where lumber and timber grows better in Oregon than anywhere in the world, anywhere. And we have been our own worst enemy. And I just don't see in your data, I would like to have you go examine all the rules and regulations that have been piled on, making it increasingly more difficult for anyone to cut timber, among other things. And this is just my opinion here, but I can't help but getting it out again. And then you add all these on, and it makes it increase. And it isn't just timber; it's land use. It's we don't have a land use process in this state. We have a process to deny land use in this state. And it's the last 30 years; it's become increasingly more prohibitive. It's a path to no. It's true for power, citing power generating facilities, the pipelines and power lines that go with it. If we had to build a port of Portland again right now, we couldn't, because those $160,000 a year people you say are moving here, well, they're that the wonderful, innovative, creative class that think their toilet paper and their food comes from Safeway. Well, guess what? It doesn't. It's great they can ride their bicycle downtown Portland to go to work. Guess what? They're indifferent, and they're totally disconnected from the very people that have built this country. And you know what? When you come to this kind of place in the economy, and then they want to know what went wrong. Well, I tell you, it's abundantly clear to me what went wrong. And I think the state has a great opportunity next year to put some reason into this processes we have and get those good-paying jobs back. I just cannot leave here without saying that, because it's true. So there you go. Any questions of this wonderful man and the great stuff he's provided us with today? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Graham, can you tell us a little bit about average manufacturing wage rates in Oregon, maybe over the last decade or two, and the number of people employed in heavy manufacturing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, I will get back to you on the wages, only because I don't have solid numbers in my mind and I don't want to kind of give you something I'll regret later. I can talk certainly about the employment levels, because that's something we publish every month and I use in many speeches. The employment levels in manufacturing in Oregon, they have declined in every single recession. But what tends to happen is that they then grow out of the recession, but they never get back to the old starting point. So it's kind of like a roller coaster where there's some growth and then there's the next recession and we lose a lot. And then we do add some, which is different to a lot of states. And one of the reasons that Oregon has suffered a lot in the last two recessions is that we do have a good viable manufacturing sector if you compare that with a lot of other states. And manufacturing got hammered in the last two recessions, and we lost a lot.
Well, on that right there, I was talking to a vice president of Samsung in Seoul, Korea, with my good friend, Representative Esquivel, and he made it very clear to us, came down to Oregon and Texas. They chose Texas, and I couldn't get him to say it, but I believe it was our land use system that they said, you know what, the permit process, I'm sure, I'm convinced that's why they chose Texas over us. Not to want to be Texas. And I'm not against urban growth boundaries and well-thought-out land use. But it's absurd. We have a path to know, and I'm going to keep hammering on that like a pile driver all next year. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a follow-up. Graham, for those who would lose their jobs in the recession and that kind of ratcheting down is in successive recessions in terms of the numbers of employed in that industry, if I'm one of the unfortunate few that loses my job in manufacturing and I have to seek a job in another industry, what would my, on average, my wage rate look like in another job compared to what it looked like when I was in manufacturing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I mean, in many industries it would clearly be lower, and again, I don't have dollar figures just right at my head, but manufacturing is one of the better paying industries, and also we did a survey of benefits a few years ago, and it's also an industry that offers better benefits than a lot of others. So the risk there is if you were in a decent manufacturing job with decent wages and good benefits and you get laid off and that company or industry is not coming back, you know, there's certainly a risk, depending where you end up, that you'll end up with lower wages and lower benefits. Now, some manufacturing workers retrain, and they go to work in industries, you know, maybe healthcare, where the benefits can be good and the wages can be good, depending what they retrained as. But for a lot of people, right, that can be a very tough adjustment. And I would liken it back to the graph I showed earlier of the early 80s, where we did lose so many jobs for a variety of reasons, and again, even for those that went back to work in their original industry, the wages were often lower. So, I mean, it's all part of this long-term challenge that we have.
Thank you very much.
And before I go to Representative Esquivel, and then Representative Hoyle, and then Representative Hovey, I want to make it clear again. I'm really grateful you came here today.
Mr. Chair,
this is just right. This is just exactly what I need. Because I think there's so much evidence in here backing up what I'm just talking about. I think it's irrefutable. Representative Esquivel, Hoyle, then
Hovey. Representative Hovey was before me. But
all right, then we'll go that way. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How don't you keep track of that?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm trying to be fair.
My colleague, Representative Shoffer, Chair Shoffer, and I agree so much on what's happened in this state. And I use an example today discussing this with Representative Shoffer in his office that what has happened when we did lose the timber industry, and we've basically lost the timber industry. What you've done is kind of like a baseball team. You had a 400 hitter in the lineup, and that was the Ted Williams. You benched Ted and put in a 150 hitter, which in turn drops your whole economic vitality, not only of the region, but of the state itself. When I first got out of the service, out of Vietnam, I came home and pulled green chain in a green end, veneer, and I made $3.74 an hour. That was in 1970. It would be interesting to see what that would be worth today if it had ratcheted up according to inflation and everything else. Today, wood products pays around $8 or $9 an hour. And I can't believe that $3.75 or $3.74 at the time would not have surpassed $8 or $9. So what we've done, in essence, is the influx of population, with the lack of ability of people to have manufacturing due to some of our land use laws, and that we've virtually taken away the timber industry, the few that are left have such a variety of people to pick from and choose from that we drop those wages. I firmly believe that. The other thing that's something that I would like to see in this presentation, there's two things. One is, in the state of Oregon, what is the ratio of people that have moved here that have retired? I think that's a significant factor. It's fixed income. The other thing is, how many people in the state of Oregon in a ratio compared to the rest of the United States are on some kind of subsistence from the state or the federal government? I think that would have a factor on this as well. So without that, I'll be quiet.
Thank you, Representative Holby. We'll go to Representative Hoyle. She's ready to go.
Oh, are you ready?
Ladies first.
All right, thank you.
Oh, here
I just
we
want
go.
To show I'm a team player. So what I would like to go back to, Graham, is one of the things that you said was that our manufacturing base is stronger and a larger, I think, percentage of our jobs than in many other states. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, what I was talking about particularly was the fact that we've managed to kind of bounce back
right.
from recessions, whereas some states just kind of kept going down and never bounced back. So, and I'm sure that our manufacturing as a percent of total is higher than some states, but not a number I have ready, but we can check that. I'm sure that's true.
And I think right. that would be interesting, because one of the things where we get hit earlier and it's harder for us to come back is the mix of jobs that we have. And certainly in my district, we've lost... I think it's just around, if not over, 2,000 manufacturing jobs in a lot of the constituents in my district had those jobs, good-paying jobs with benefits, and now are in the position, as Representative Witt alluded to, where the skill set that they had isn't really fit for the new workforce. And I think we need to think about what jobs are coming up that we can – what do we need to do to get people prepared for the jobs of the future, so that we can have people making the kind of money where they can pay income tax to help fund our schools. And so that, for me, is the really critical piece. And I just have to say I'm very excited to find out that Representative Esquivel and I both agree that Ted Williams is one of the greatest players of all time. But what he did was every day he'd take 1,000 swings and really practice to make sure that he was one of the best hitters ever. And I think we need to do something so that we're practicing and putting our energies into the right areas so that we're training people to have the jobs that are going to pay well. You know, some of the highlights, I'd like to hear what some of the bright spots are. I know that in export, you know, we can export high-end goods better than many, many other states. It is a highlight, and if we can focus on whatever markets there are that have that we can sell elsewhere. But I'd like to know from you, where can we focus that energy? Where can we get those workers, those kind of jobs? How do we do that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hoyle, we do 10-year projections for the Employment Department for Oregon and each of its regions, and they're heavily used by the community colleges and across the workforce system to inform exactly those kind of decisions. Now, of course, doing it, the last ones we did was 2008 to 18, and early next year we'll be working on 2010 to 2020, and of course a lot changed since then.
Mm-hmm.
But the two or three really important things I can share: we don't predict that manufacturing will get back to its previous level in that time period. We don't predict that construction will get back to its previous level, and that's a 10-year time period. Both of them will add jobs, but they won't get back to their pre-recession levels. Where would some of the growth be? Healthcare is the long-time lead, and it almost gets redundant and boring to say it because it's been true so long. But healthcare is probably the one industry, even today, where across the industry there are some pretty severe shortages. And the reason is healthcare didn't really lay many people off, but they still are growing. Most other industries, even if they're growing today, they laid off so many people in the recession that you would think there's a lot of people just sitting there ready, trained, already skilled up. The other conversation is kind of the small skill changes. If you were laid off from one kind of construction company, but you have basic construction skills, you know, assembly or machining or whatever it is, maybe there's just a small skills change that you need to go work in a different industry but doing the same thing. So that's a lot different than going from manufacturing to healthcare, for example. So we're working with transition teams and with workforce boards on a lot of data on those issues. In fact, at the workforce board last Friday, I just gave a whole presentation on that. So
just a quick follow-up. My understanding from what I've read, and you're clearly more knowledgeable, is that between 80 and 85% of the jobs for the future will require some kind of post-secondary education or workforce training. And is that your understanding? Is that your...
Mr. Chair and Representative Hoyle, I don't have the number on top of my head. So many numbers in my business. That may be a little high, but a huge number of them will require some post-secondary education. So, something that kind of gets in the numbers there is that there's a huge part of the economy that is relatively low wage and that doesn't even require a high school education. And so when we start putting those percentages out, those low wage retail sales, restaurant, food service kind of jobs, I mean, they're huge occupations in terms of the number of people that work there. That doesn't mean they're the kind of high wage, pay taxes, support a family job that you want to be training for. So you get this kind of high wage discussion as opposed to the all jobs where some of those lower ones are the mass. But we have lots of data and lots of you know graphs and slides that we can bring to you or to the group if you'd like on that.
Great. Thank you so much.
Before I go to Richardson, Holvey, I look forward to the day when we're exporting more lumber again instead of importing logs to keep our mills going. I look forward to the day when we don't have to import gravel and aggregate into the state because we can't mine it in our own state because these absurd prohibitive regulations and processes that deny us the ability to do that. I want us exporting energy from this state, wind, solar, LNG, nuclear, hydro. That's what I want to see. You know, we're our own worst enemies, and it just drives me to distraction. Representative Holvey,
would you announce what the information I received on the wages? That's very
I'd be happy to. According to Mr. Tribbett's calculations, and I have no way to back this up, but someone's calculated off the internet. Online inflation calculator, $3.50 in 1970 would amount to $19 in 2009. Well, there's a lot of people out there right now today would love to have a $19 an hour
job.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I was just getting back to Representative Witt's inquiry a while back about manufacturing jobs and looking at the decline of that. And obviously it appears that perhaps they were higher wage jobs in 1970 than they are today then. But I think in looking at that employment drop, certainly, you know, I think we need to increase our manufacturing base as well in Oregon. But I think you also have to, I don't know if your department has, you probably have the access to the information, I guess, when you look at the decline of manufacturing jobs, if you can consider that in terms of productivity too, because I believe, and I know many people used to work in mills who got replaced by a machine, mechanization and innovation has also displaced a great deal of those manufacturing-based jobs. So I think you have to, you know, have a little slot in there too that perhaps productivity has gone up because of mechanization, and it's not as labor-intensive as a job as it used to be. I mean, we got tree felling that's done by a machine instead of four or five guys now out in the woods, you know. And so I think, you know, that has to be, if you're going to look at these numbers and really try to make sense out of the manufacturing base and the number of jobs that are there, you have to look at of that productivity issue as well and see how many jobs have been lost to mechanization and innovation as well, because it doesn't take as many people to run a mill today as it did 20, 30 years ago. There's so much of it's done by machinery now that, you know, I mean, that's just the way it's gone. So, you know, when you look at those figures and report back to us about the employment drop, I'm wondering if you can have a category that's not due to actually the industry slowing down, but actually due to, you know, modernization and mechanization of the industry, so it's not as labor-intensive as an industry as it used to be.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I agree, and yes, I don't know that we'll be able to allocate, you know, X number of jobs to productivity, but there's definitely data that shows with this many employees the trend and the total production, the trend, And clearly, I mean, we know from over many years that the productivity of a lot of industries is way up, even at the same time as you say, employment's down. And certain mills, I remember even in the 80s, when I was very new in this business, I toured a sawmill, and it was over in Dallas, and this old gentleman was doing the tour, a retired worker. He'd worked his whole career there. And I remember him telling this group that was touring that, you know, back in the day, there were 200, we were up on this walkway, and I can still picture it. Back in the day, there were 200 men, all men, right? 200 men down there in the sawmill. And as we looked down, there was about five people down there with pipe poles. Their only job was to free the logs from the conveyor belts. That was it. Everything else was computerized. And that was in the late 80s. So and you know it's continued since then. So there's a lot of factors. I mean, there's environmental factors. If you remember, it was the spotted owl. It was productivity. It was a lot of factors at play. And you have certain ones that, you know, you've already talked about. But the bottom line is manufacturing is producing a lot, but with far fewer workers, certainly, in some industries than we had before.
Well, hopefully what used to be a slash pile or get put into a burning teepee will create some energy out of that and add on to that jobs, offset that loss. And I don't know if that's going to work out. You know, I hope it does. Right. And I want to comment once on the healthcare industry, too. I'm a huge supporter of the healthcare industry. OHSU has been very good to me. My wife is a dentist, graduated from OHSU. We live where we live because of her income, her diligent, incredible work ethic, and the income it provides her and seven people that work for her. Mm-hmm. So I am a huge supporter of the healthcare industry, and I want it to be wildly successful in this state. But the fact of the matter is, that's a service. That ain't some guy out there milling a piece of lumber. It's different. If you have somebody manufacturing or adding value to something, that's where the money comes from for that service. Without the one, you don't have the service. So I'm all for it, but we cannot forget. And I think so many people in this building, they love. I love to talk about higher ed too. I'm all for higher ed, K-12. Let's educate our workforce. But if there's no need for a workforce, you don't need an educated worker. And if there's no money to pay the dentist, your teeth fall out. So, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. You mentioned that there were about 350, occupations where hiring is occurring. I'm wondering if you could share with us perhaps the top five occupations that might be out, so I could tell my constituents, hey, this is the direction right now. And if you know it, maybe if you don't now, maybe share it with us later, the corresponding pay for these occupations.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, yes, we have all kinds of publications that we put out along those lines. Oregon's high demand occupations. I mean, some of this stuff takes a longer term look and says, you know, if you want a good career, what should you be training for with the wages? So we have that kind of thing. Then there's kind of today's problem. Again, there's a lot of unemployed and not many openings. We've just been analyzing that from several different views, and a lot of the jobs that are proving hard to fill right now, some of them are customer service reps, which would be the call center kind of thing. Believe it or not, truck drivers, some of these are always on the list, in good economy and bad. But truck drivers, we still have loads. When I say loads of openings, it's relative to, you know, the relatively small number, but proportionately, a lot of openings. And of course, right now, at this time of year, somewhat seasonal, retail sales, there's lots of openings. Now, that sounds pretty dismal in the sense that those aren't the kind of things you want to send your constituents to. If you move on down the list, there are going to be a lot of openings in healthcare. And there's going to be some openings across a range, engineering, those kind of things. I mean, higher level professional occupations, they're all on the list. But the big five, again, tend to be dominated partly because of high turnover by some of the lower wage occupations. So the retail sales, the customer service, some of the food preparation, they're always towards the top of the list. It's not necessarily the long-term goal. But.
Follow up. You mentioned healthcare, and that encompasses a number of occupations. Mm-hmm. Could you narrow that down, perhaps?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher. So among healthcare, there's pretty much been growth across all of the areas. So there's what we call ambulatory care, you know, doctor's offices, dentist offices. And overall, they've been growing. Hospitals have been growing. And then the long-term care, kind of residential homes, that one certainly has been growing. And I think one of the things to keep in mind is as the population here ages, and we do have more retirees still moving to Oregon, we're all going to be demanding more health care. You know, where the money comes to pay from it is one thing, but simply because sure we're is. 50 or 60 or 70 years old, we'll be demanding more health care. So it's pretty much across the range. We did a study several years, 2006, of shortage health care occupations. And, I mean, it had all kinds of technologists through to registered nurses and physicians. It's just a lot of health care occupations at all different wage ranges, CNAs. So high to low, we're going to need more of most of them in the future.
Representative, are you finished, Representative?
I am.
Representative
Esquivel,
please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Real brief, Representative Witt and I sat in on this very discussion about a year ago, and I believe the two top demands at that time for occupations was nurses, and I think the number two was a welder. Is that correct, Representative Witt?
That's my recollection, too.
Well, they're cranking out welders as fast as we need them at Local 20, Iron Workers Local 29, Portland, among the other good, great locals.
Mr. Chair, just one more follow-up to Representative Thatcher, because I happen to remember I do have the list of the top ones with me. So going down it right now, these are the things that businesses think they'll be hiring for in the next 6 months. Yeah. Retail sales, truck drivers, administrative assistants, construction laborers, farm workers. Now that's going to push us, you know, into the spring. So that's probably, or it could have been Christmas tree. You know, again, some of these are very seasonal. Restaurant cooks, receptionists, customer service reps, waiters, waitresses. That's kind of the top 10. So it just gives you a flavor. If you go on down, you see auto service. You see some teachers even. Elementary school teachers was on the list. So kind of a surprise. There is lots more information I'd be happy to provide to you.
Thank you.
I hate to think of all the public employees we're going to lay off after next year's budget. It's going to really put a dent in your graph up there.
Yes, sir.
Any further questions of Mr. Slater? I really appreciate this. This is fascinating stuff. And actually, I'd like you to come back. I don't know what the assignments will be, but if I'm sitting here with, I would like you to come back sometime next session and, you know, just give us a refresher on all this.
Be happy to. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you very much. Have a merry one. All right, folks, all we have left is, if I'm not wrong, is introduction of bills.
Yeah, you need to open a work session, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures. Representative Esquivel, you'd be so kind to move to make those. And I want to share with all of you. We'll go ahead and make the motion, and then I'll...
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that LC 243, LC 419, LC 433, LC 434, LC 999, LC 1241, LC 1390, LC 1595, LC 1827, LC 1828, LC 1853, we're the fourth of the way there, folks. LC 2095, LC 2164, LC 2287, LC 2367, LC 2425, LC 78, I think that's 2828, LC 1276 or 1226?
26.
Is that 1226?
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a two there. LC 1226, LC 2415.
That's it, Representative. That's just a duplicate.
Gotcha.
All right. The good representative has moved.
He introduced his committee bills.
All right. So this does not in any way tie anyone to support or opposition to any of these concepts. We just made a committee bill, and we'll go from there. Is there any opposition to the motion? Is there any discussion on the motion? All right, so we'll close the work session. And I just want to thank everyone. It's been a great 2 years. Vice Chair Cameron isn't here, but I appreciate his help and work. And Representative Vice Chair Barton isn't here either. I really appreciate his help and work on this committee, and it's been a great committee. And I hope to see all of you back here next year. So with that, everybody have a merry one. Unless there's anything else for the good of the order?
Towards some kind of gender neutrality.
All right, then. We're adjourned. So.